The following audio file was recorded on April 8th in Nashville, Tennessee by Earnhardt Productions Incorporated at a voting rights and election reform conference titled Gathering to Save Our Democracy. It has been uploaded to this site courtesy of the January 30th Coalition, an Ohio-based voting rights group which endorsed the conference. You are welcome to copy and distribute or broadcast this recording. Please also consider making a donation to Radio for All so that recordings like this one can continue to be made available.
I'm Josh Middledorf. I tell people I teach statistics at Temple University, which is already a stretch of my qualifications. I've been working with Kathy at the National Election Data Archive, and I've written an article in these times. Mostly, applauding yourselves, really. What I wanted to start by saying is that I'm really humbled. When I hear the kind of devotion that people have had, I hear the other speakers and the work that they've done on the details, the one vote at a time, collecting the data, collecting the individual stories. This is tremendously inspiring to me. And what I've done is very easy in comparison. I have some communication skills. I've put them to use at the service of a very important cause. But you folks are the heroes. I want to talk, if I can have some help from the timer, I want to talk about 5 minutes on the Matovsky-Edison data and reserve 10 minutes to talk about where we are, what we have to do, and to relate to you four stories of my experience in that area. So give me a warning at 10 minutes in addition. I prefer to talk about what happened in the large scale in terms of Matovsky-Edison's own data. The Matovsky report of January 19th is actually two different things. The data in the report and the analysis is quite sound and quite competent. The executive summary that's tacked on at the beginning has no relation to the rest of the report. And I think we do better when we don't try to explain our own analyses, but just show the data that Matovsky has given us, which is already quite powerful. This is from Matovsky's own table. The blue curve is what would be expected. It's zero standard deviations in the middle and one standard deviation to the sides. It's the bell-shaped curve for the difference between each state's official vote count and the projections from exit polls done by Matovsky Edison. And as you can see, the bell-shaped curve is right there, but the whole thing is shifted toward Bush. The whole thing is shifted a little more than one standard deviation. And this gives you very graphically the message that this was a whole country phenomenon, that the whole country was involved in this. It doesn't necessarily mean that it was a coordinated effort. It could be just a lot of different people that had the permission and the motivation to act independently. We don't know that yet, but we do know that whatever happened, it happened in the country at large. Over on the left, apart from the bell-shaped distribution, or those three states, that's New Hampshire, Vermont, and New York, which seems to be special cases. There are four standard deviations toward Bush, and I don't know what happened there. Next slide is about response to the exit polls, and the only reason this is important is, well, let me back up. WPE. Okay, is that better? WPE, within precinct error. This is a point that I make when I try to make it simply, and I hope you will all carry this message out. The strongest way to describe what Matovsky found in the report is not to talk about the exit polls projection for the entire country, and the difference between that and the vote in the entire country. But to talk about the raw data in individual precincts, what they found was that in the individual precincts that they sampled, who knows whether they selected them right. They actually did a good job of selecting them, but we don't even have to talk about that. In the precincts that they sampled, there was a difference between the vote count of the people that walked out of those precincts and said, I just voted for John Kerry, and the official counts from those very same precincts which said, well, it looked like that precinct went for Bush. So this is a much starker difference, and it's much more transparent when you look at it this way. All of the error, quote error, in the Matovsky program is within precinct error, which means we don't need fancy statistics, and we don't, and this, when you analyze the probability that this could have happened by chance, you get a very, very large number, many, many millions, when you look at it this way instead of looking, talking about clustering samples and esoteric phenomena like that. So there really only are two possibilities if this is true. The one possibility is that the votes weren't counted right. And the other possibility is that of the people that walked out of the polling place, more of them were Kerry supporters that cooperated with the pollsters than Bush supporters. This is the, quote, reluctant Bush hypothesis. And the way to debunk that is exactly with this, which I've lost already, this plot, which says that the highest rate of cooperation with the pollsters was on the right in this, in the areas where 80% and more of that precinct went for Bush. It's exactly the opposite of what you'd expect if the Matovsky hypothesis of the reluctant Bush voter was true. I talked about the executive summary. The executive summary says, well, there was a difference, and the only way we can explain the difference is that more Bush voters than Kerry voters cooperated with the polls. And here's the best evidence that that wasn't true. And it, of course, leaves the other hypothesis that Matovsky was not willing to talk about, but which you and I all know to be the reality of why there was a difference between the exit polls and the official count. The last slide, this shows the difference between exit poll and official count by Kerry strongholds on the left, Bush strongholds on the right. You can see that the difference was the highest in the Bush strongholds. It was 10% difference between what people said when they walked out of the polling place and what was recorded officially. And it's also interesting that that's the mean. The median tracks the mean for all those points except the last one. There's a big divergence between the median and the mean. What does that mean? In statistics, when the median is different from the mean, it means that there are a few outliers that are pushing the whole distribution off. And this is prima facie evidence of large-scale voter theft in a very small number of places. In other words, there are precincts that are known to Matovsky, which precincts they are, where the difference was huge. And it wasn't every predominantly Republican precinct, but in the ones where it happened, massive numbers of votes were moved. That's what the evidence looks like. So now I want to tell you the story of, where do I think we are, and what am I doing about it, and what do I see our problems are? It's, what I want to devote the rest of this this time to. We're the scientists. We come here. Our definition of reality is scientific reality because we gather evidence, we put it together using logic. We live in a world of social reality, where reality is defined by what people hear on the radio. What's the patter of people around me? What do other people around me believe? what are the politicians saying? This is social reality. There's a divergence between social reality and scientific reality. We're the minority who rely on our own intellects and rely on evidence to judge what reality is. For the majority of people in this country, I'd say a substantial majority, the reality is a social reality. And we haven't done very well at bringing the scientific reality into harmony with the social reality. I'll tell you four stories. Joe Huffel was the... I was hoping for the 10-minute. Joe Huffel was the Senate candidate from my state. He's an old friend of my family. He had to return my phone calls. He lost to Arlen Specter. But I had a chance to have lunch with him last month, where I put a lot of this evidence in front of him and said, look, Pennsylvania was one of the states where there was this biggest WPE. There were places that are known to Matofsky and Edison that these are precincts where if we get discovery from Matofsky Edison with a lawsuit, we can find out what precincts they were where the fraud took place, and we can launch an investigation. Won't you, as a Senate candidate who has standing to start a lawsuit and who has the ability to command press attention, won't you take this cause forward? Joe Huffel listened very attentively to what I had to say, and he said, well, if this were true, how come I'm not reading about it in the New York Times? Social reality. He said, well, you know, this is supposed to be a big fraud in Ohio. What is Dennis Kucinich saying about this? Dennis Kucinich doesn't return my phone calls. Well, Joe, would you call Dennis Kucinich? I'll call Dennis and see what he has to say. Well, it's a month later, and he said, oh, yeah, I was going to call Dennis. So we'll see what comes from that, but I'm not hopeful. Second story, Paul Krugman. You know, as you know, Paul Krugman has been writing columns for a year before the election about the possibility that the vote could be stolen, showing up very clearly the vulnerabilities of the election system. On election day, he was off on a book writing leave. After election day, he's come back to writing his columns. He's talked only about Social Security. He hasn't said a word about the elections. Where is Paul Krugman? What happens that an old friend of mine, a good friend of mine, went to school with Paul Krugman at Brandeis years and years ago and has a personal line to Paul Krugman. So I said, Uri, call Paul Krugman. Find out what happened. Uri called Paul. Actually, he had a chance to visit with Paul Krugman. He looked him in the eye and said, how come you're not writing about this? Paul Krugman looked down and said, you know, that's a long story. I don't have time to tell you. I'll tell you in an email. The email never came. I don't know what's going on with Paul Krugman. I don't know what's going on with Joe Huffel. I'll tell you another story. A friend of mine said, you know, after she listened to me describe what I've been doing the last few months, she said, Eliot Spitzer is the person we need to get about. Eliot Spitzer is fearless and incorruptible. I said, right. If I had a line to Eliot Spitzer, I'd use it. Well, the very next day, somebody called me up out of the blue and said, you know, there's a guy we want you to meet in New York, but the only time he can see you happens to be, you know, he's going to New York for an Eliot Spitzer fundraiser. Would you mind meeting him there? This was last Monday. So I said, I think I can do that. I got on a train. I went into New York for no other purpose than to spend 2 minutes looking Eliot Spitzer in the eye, describing what I could as best I could in that 2 minutes, handing him a letter and a packet, including the article by me and Steve Freeman. He listened. I do believe he's incorruptible. I do believe he's brave. But Steve got a call from his office just the other day. Yes, it looks like you have important evidence here, but we can't launch an investigation based just on exit polls. It just isn't enough. That's Eliot Spitzer's answer. These are three failures. I'll tell you one success story. A friend of mine in the neighborhood said, "You know, I've got connections at the Chestnut Hill Local. It's a local paper, probably has a distribution of 20,000. I can get anything published there." I said, "They don't talk about national politics at the Chestnut Hill Local." Well, she very artfully wrote up a story about local activist, and she trumpeted my credentials in a way I would never have dared to do, and told the story in terms of personal human interest story, but she fit in the story about what I'm doing and the evidence that the election was stolen nationally. So what does that mean? I think it means that we know something about scientific reality that the politicians don't know. They know something about political reality that we don't know. Perhaps it's possible to feel out the ways to get publicity. I'm hoping to learn from all of you in the next day or so what you've tried to get the word out, to share ideas. I have a feeling that the answer is going to be that even though we know what happened last November, that the politically viable way to push our message forward is to not talk about that, but to talk about the potential for the vote being corrupted and what we need to do to avoid the possibility of corruption in the future. That's what I'm thinking, but I'm hoping to hear more from you. Thanks for your attention.
Okay, welcome everybody. I see we're filling in, and this is good. The audience outnumbers the speakers now, which is a major step in the right direction. So while Bernie loads up my one slide that I'm going to show, I'm going to scramble things a little bit because Josh, I'm going to sort of pick up where he left off on some of this. And it's going to be a little bit of mixed nuts, but here goes. When we have the graph up? It's going to be a little bit. Okay, so one of the questions, I mean, we're hearing stuff, there are all these anomalies, there are all these machines that switch votes, we got, you know, all sorts of iceberg tips coming out all over the place, chicken pox, as I like to call them, evidence that there's an underlying disease. And we know, pretty much everybody in this room, you know, minus any infiltrators who happen to be here, and they know too, actually, that basically that there is so much. I mean, they know better than we know, right? They really know, whoever you are or aren't. But there is so much that is so wrong with this picture. There is so much. And one of the questions is, you know, well, how do you differentiate something that is systematically wrong from just all this noise? Because in any election, you're going to have things that go wrong. You're going to have machines, reports of machines that don't work or reverse votes. And that's a really strong bias in terms of, you know, how the media covered all this and how everybody's looking at it. Well, you know, you're not going to have perfect elections. You're counting 120 million votes, et cetera, et cetera. So we have, for starters, a graph here, and I promise it's my only slide. Do we have an electric pointer or we don't? We don't, I don't think, right? Okay, I'll wander over there. That basically reiterates something that has been stated, but I this shows it fairly graphically. And that is, this is the popular vote. And what's significant about this is the national popular vote. And Edison Matovsky, in their exit polls, did about 70,000+ respondents on the state level. And out of that, a subsample was selected to mirror the national profile. And this is what you got. And that subsample had in it, we thought 13,047 voters. I mean, it's been revised a couple of times. But it's okay. Thank you. It's up there. It's up there. Lots and lots of respondents. Your average exit poll, your average poll, you know, pre-election poll, you're looking at maybe 2,000 respondents nationwide. This is six times as much. It gives you a very small margin of error, very high confidence that you're getting accurate results. And what we got out of this for the popular vote is this rather steep chart here, and there are a lot of little labels on it. But basically, this is what the exit polls told us Kerry got, 50.8%. And this is what the vote count told us he got, 48.1%. And the reason that's way off the curve is that's a steep curve because there were a lot of respondents. Gives you great accuracy. And so this thing over here, for the mathematically minded, is 4.7 standard deviations away. That is out there by Neptune somewhere. That is way, way off the curve. There's no possibility, no realistic possibility that this could be compatible with this by chance. It just isn't. So we've sort of told you that. And there's one other line on here worth looking at, and that's this break-even point for winning the popular vote line. And that occurs at about 49.54% because of minor party candidates and whatnot. It's not 50%. And if you look at that line and you look at where that falls on the curve, this little mini triangle here is the chance that Bush won the popular vote. And the whole rest of the area under the curve here, this whole big chunk here, is the chance that Kerry won the popular vote. About 98%, pretty much no matter what assumptions you use. I mean, you can play with fudge factors. You know, you heard some talk about cluster factors. I mean, those are fundamentally meaningless because we know that Edison Matofsky verified their own sample. And in exit polling, you have two questions. Was the sample good? Did we sample the right precincts? And then what happened within those precincts when we tried to interview people? And what we know is the sample was good. So there's no cluster effect whatsoever. Retroactively, looking at it, not in theory now, looking at it forward, but looking at it back, we know there was no cluster effect. So our numbers are actually better than what has been published. And what happened is there's this big within-precinct error, and Josh attempted to demolish the reluctant Bush responder hypothesis. It gets a little more complicated. If anybody wants to come to Election Statistics 301 tomorrow morning, we'll go into some of the, you know, deeper nuances. But take it from me, it's demolished. It was a hypothesis, it was a postulate from the beginning. It was based on nothing other than, help, we got to find some reason for all this. Yeah. Now, what the heck could it be? You know, well, it isn't anything else. I guess they didn't respond. But the numbers don't support it. As a matter of fact, the numbers refute it, no matter how you slice it. And we've done pretty extensive analysis. So here's where I'd like to go with this. We basically have no evidence of polling error. We have a long history of basically pretty accurate exit polling, keeping in mind that the methodology has only gotten better. And they learn from iteration. They learn from successive mistakes to minimize those mistakes, gotten better and better. And Edison Matofsky had an especially strong incentive to make this the best goddamn exit poll that has ever been run in the history of 40 or you know, so years of exit polling. There was a lot of incentive for that, and they worked at it very hard and very meticulously and very conscientiously. It was better than what they did in the Ukraine. It was better than what they did in 2000 or 1998. So we have blessed numbers on our side, and as Josh referred to it, the scientific reality. So then the question becomes, and this is where I'm sort of treading on what he said, is why do we find ourselves in the position we're in? Why are there 70 of us here, you know, devoted souls, when there were 500,000 people in the streets in the Ukraine, when that election was rerun. And we're just sort of sitting here going, oh, you know, help, this is going to happen again and again and again. And what are we going to do about it? What are we going to, you know, we're going to march? So I began to think about that, over the past week or so, and certainly the last night. And I looked at a quote from Warren Matofsky, and he said, in a democracy, it's the orderly transfer of power, that keeps the democracy accepting the results of elections. If it drags on too long, there's always a suspicion of fraud. And I began to think about that, and I began to think about, well, maybe they're right. What would be the consequences of our having a full house and that becoming 500,000 people in the streets? And basically, what would be the consequences of our getting our point across? And they'd be dreadful, be drastic, terrible consequences. Corporate structure. I mean, for all of us in the ownership society here who own lots of stock, I mean, our stocks would go down. I mean, if you bought gold, that would go up. So, you know, if you had the inside information that we were about to win, you could make a killing. But basically, the dollar, it's hanging by a thread. The Chinese are ready to dump, right? Goodbye. Forget it. Whole economy is ruined. Chaos. Riots in the streets. Call out the National Guard. And certainly the military and this whole bold new venture of the American empire. So I've been thinking about this, and I think that we should probably soft pedal our message. I think that what we should probably do is back off and sort of stick to the sort of innocuous kind of fig leaf legislative reforms and, you know, the Ensign Bill, the Holt Bill, and stuff like that, and stop talking about fraud. Stop really going after the jugular here. It's too dangerous. I mean, if we talk about reform and we talk about the future and we kind of play within the system, we won't endanger the whole American system. We won't bring it crashing down. So I actually think we should probably adjourn the conference and go out and... and head home early and reconsider. So who's with me on that? Who's with? Nobody. Okay, good. Yeah, that's what I like to hear. My next question is, do you think for a minute that Count Olaf, and you know who he is, collectively and individually, Count Olaf, series of unfortunate events, right? Count Olaf, the arch villain, didn't know this, doesn't know this, didn't use it to advantage, didn't know how this would play out, didn't recognize way ahead of Josh and myself or anybody else that there is a scientific reality or a real reality and a social reality and a media reality and know the difference and be more than one step ahead in this curve and is still ahead. So my message about that, elections, as Josh said, and just to rephrase a little bit, they don't take place in a laboratory. The stakes are incredibly high. And it's not facts that governs what happens after an election. It's spin. It's momentum. It's herd behavior, H-E-R-D. And we have to account for this in all our strategies going forward. California looks like it's the end of the road. They win California, we're done. You can forget about the other states. It's over from a presidential standpoint. So, I mean, we have to start thinking that way, playing poker and playing it well and bringing out that message to people. You know, I want to read just one. My time's running short, but I want to read two little things. One is a letter I wrote to the Globe, and I said this was in November, after the election, November 16th. I said, of course, unprinted, of the approximately 31,600 words of journalism in yesterday's Globe, not one was devoted to what is surely the number one story in America, the mounting evidence that election 2004 was, to put it bluntly, rigged. When the autopsy of our democracy is performed, it is my belief that media silence will be given as the primary cause of death. And there is a segment here where we are our own media, and we're going to have to do that. And the other little thing I'd like to read is part of a response. Roxanne and I have had a bit of an email dialogue going. We've been sort of been somewhat intemperate in it. And I was talking about the battle, and I was saying it will be won, our battle, if it is to be won, when a combination of factors converge. Among these factors will be the hubristic abuse of both their governing and election rigging power by a power-drunk ruling party, and to some extent their out-of-power collaborators, let's not forget that, as well as ongoing efforts to expose the reality and to prepare the American psyche for this massive blow, as well as providing working models for recovery, systems that work for fair and honorable elections on the local level. It is likely, however, that legislation that gives the false impression of addressing this dreadful and terminal illness, while not in fact doing what is necessary to cure it, e.g. HAVA, the Ensign Bill, the Holt Bill, will only falsely soothe the public and prolong the dark revolution.
Our victory will not come from the jailing of Catherine Harris or Ken Blackwell. It will come from the bursting of public consciousness from its tight confinement. This is a geometrical and decidedly nonlinear process, virtually invisible in its early phases, very powerful when it matures. Slamming our heads against the wall is no fun, and our heads are going to be gory messes by the time this is over. But I'm afraid that's how this wall will have to come down. And I just want to close by saying, unlike 2000, the message that we're giving here, there may not be a whole lot of us, but we are pretty damn convicted. And we're not going to sit down, and we're not going to shut up, and we're not going to move on. And that's what we have to let people know. Thank you.
For those of you who weren't here yesterday or don't know me, I'm Dr. Richard Hayes Phillips. I, without planning to do so, ended up working tirelessly on the Moss versus Bush lawsuit, which sought to overturn the election results in Ohio. I worked not analyzing the exit polls, but analyzing the precinct data in the unofficial and official election results. The lawsuit really involved a two-pronged attack, because whenever there is a major discrepancy between exit polls and election results, as in Ukraine or the United States, a careful scrutiny of the vote totals, precinct by precinct, will reveal what is correct and what is not. I mean, there's only three possibilities with such a discrepancy. Either the exit polls are wrong, or the election results are wrong, or some of both. And if the election has been fraudulent, there will be evidence of voter suppression and inexplicable irregularities in the reported results. And this is what we find in Ohio. Unbeknownst to my fellow panelists, I did keep abreast of all the drafts and comments back and forth on their report, and was so well satisfied with the job that they were doing that I just let them go ahead and stayed with my own realm of expertise. Since not everybody was here yesterday, I will touch briefly on some of what I said then to bring you up to speed. There are still 92,000 uncounted regular ballots in Ohio. Still, even today, no one has looked at them. These are mostly punch cards, and in I examined the results in 7 of 8 counties with the highest number of uncounted ballots, ballots cast that where the machines recorded no vote for president. I found them to be highly concentrated in precincts that voted overwhelmingly for John Kerry by margins in the aggregate of 12 to 1 in Cleveland, 7 to 1 in Dayton, 5 to 1 in Cincinnati, 4.5 to 1 in Akron. It is a reasonable supposition that most of those votes were for John Kerry. In Ohio, the order in which candidates' names appear on the ballot must by law rotate from precinct to precinct in the name of fairness. And in Cleveland especially, where many polling stations have several precincts voting in the same place, this is an open invitation to fraud. If a voter is given a punch card for a certain precinct for which the tabulator will read the card in a certain way. And if that voter is then allowed to vote on a voting machine intended for a different precinct where the candidates' names are ordered differently, the votes will be shifted in one direction or another to a different column. Usually one column to the left or right, sometimes two. So the usual ways this affected the vote was either Kerry votes would go to Bush, and Bush votes would go Libertarian. And now in Cleveland, where Kerry got 83% of the vote and was carrying many of these precincts by 92, 95, 98% of the vote, Bush doesn't have a lot of votes to lose. So it's a huge net gain if he picks up Kerry votes and loses a few votes to the Libertarian column. Or conversely, in the other direction, if Bush votes go to Kerry, then the Kerry votes will go to candidate disqualified, who used to be Ralph Nader. And after he was stricken from the ballot, the column remained on the punch cards. And the tabulators were programmed to count that column as zero, no matter how many people stood in line for 4 hours to vote for candidate disqualified. We also have sworn affidavits from voters in Cleveland who were given punch cards with the hole for Bush already punched out of them. These punch cards are in envelopes. I suspect that most voters, when removing the card from the envelope, did not hold it up to the light to see if it was already punched for anybody. I suspect that most of them probably put it right in the machine. And if they cast a vote for Bush, they'd be casting a valid ballot. If they cast a vote for Kerry, they'd be spoiling their ballot with an overvote, and the tabulator would spit it out. And as I understand the process, wouldn't count a vote for any office whatsoever. So why don't we get to look at the ballots? 85% of the votes in Ohio have a paper trail. And we don't get to look at the punch cards? Is it because in Cleveland we would find inordinate numbers of not only hanging chads for Kerry, but overvotes for both Bush and Kerry because the cards were already punched in advance? Or thousands of votes for candidate disqualified? In Columbus, 122 voting machines were withheld from inner city precincts that are predominantly minority and predominantly Democratic. It was intended all along not to provide 68 of these machines that remained in the warehouse. And we also obtained from a mole at the Board of Elections a redacted list naming by serial number the machines that were supposed to be brought to the polling stations in Franklin County, and another 54 machines were blacked out. All of them in Columbus, none of them in the Republican suburbs. This was a systematic, discriminatory manner of allocating voting machines in order to suppress the turnout in Kerry precincts, and it worked. The average turnout in Bush precincts was 60%. The average turnout in Kerry precincts was 50%. Those numbers are a bit artificially low because the voter lists had not been purged as they were in other counties. I mean, you're supposed to do that now and again so that people who died or moved away are removed from the polls. But that was also used, especially in Toledo, as a way to strike people from the voter rolls who were still quite alive and well and living in the same old house. And then they would go to the polls and be told, oh, you're not on the rolls, you can't vote. And if they voted by provisional ballot, the ballot wouldn't count because they weren't on the rolls. Or if they went to the wrong table in the right building and voted at the wrong precinct, their provisional ballot wouldn't count either. And those were the two very reasons why provisional ballots were designed in the first place. for people who somehow don't appear on the voter rolls but were validly registered, or people who voted in the wrong precinct and shouldn't be allowed to vote for a local race, but whose vote for president ought to be counted. In Youngstown, Ohio, Mahoning County, there were numerous reports of votes hopping from Kerry to Bush on the touch screens, or the screen going blank and not recording a vote for president. And all the data was consistent with the hypothesis that the machines were programmed to default to candidate Bush, and if you did not override that default choice, you would be voting for Bush whether you wanted to or not. Bush made his biggest gains in the very ward where half of the complaints came from. So I looked a little more carefully. I found one precinct where three voters said they tried several times before they could get the machine to register a vote for Kerry instead of Bush. And three other voters who said that the presidential choice never came up on the screen. They never got the choice to vote for president. And they walked away quite forlorn and filed complaints. Well, guess what? There are no undervotes in that precinct. Everyone who touched that screen had a vote counted for president, even the people who never saw a presidential choice appear on the screen. Given that all the other complaints in Youngstown, and in this precinct in particular, were for votes hopping from Democrat to Republican, the only conclusion is that these machines were programmed to default to candidate Bush, which would certainly help Jeb Bush if he runs in 2008. The machines are already programmed to default to him. So, I want to speak in a little more detail about southwestern Ohio than I did yesterday. There are three counties in southwestern Ohio, Claremont, Butler, and Warren County, which gave to Bush his entire margin of victory statewide. He had a bigger margin in those three counties than he had in the entire state of Ohio. To these counties, he owes his presidency. In these counties, Kerry couldn't even get the percentage of the vote that Gore had gotten, even though Nader wasn't on the ballot this time. He couldn't even get as many votes as Ellen Connolly got in her race for Chief Justice. She was an underfunded African-American municipal judge from Cleveland, not well known in southwestern Ohio. It isn't just that Kerry didn't get the percentage that she got. He didn't even get as many votes in a race that drew 1.2 million fewer voters than the presidential race. Well, there's other ways to look at these numbers, too. In Butler County, for instance, there's one town, Oxford Township, where I saw no evidence of vote rigging at all. In that township, Kerry ran 14% ahead of Al Gore. We have unaltered results in some places in Ohio that are quite consistent with the exit polls. I don't believe that 13,500 people in these three counties voted for both George Bush and Ellen Connolly. That's what would have to have happened at a minimum for these election results to be true and correct. The same people, the same bodies, and the same polling stations on the same day had their hearts and minds won by George W. Bush and an African-American municipal judge from Cleveland. I don't believe it. There are, in precinct after precinct in these counties, you find vote tallies that say that Kerry didn't even get as many votes as Bush. I mean, excuse me, as many votes as Gore. So think of it. To account for these results, where voter turnout increased dramatically compared to 2000, even though the population increased almost not at all, Bush would have had to have gotten all the new voters, all the Nader voters, and some of the Gore voters. My point is that the election results, when investigated precinct by precinct, show that it is not the exit polls that were wrong, but the official results that were wrong. And why is it that we can't have a second election and Ukraine can?
It's refreshing to have an hour and a half of a reality-based discussion these days. We were going to have Cliff Arnebeck on this afternoon on the election justice panel, but he's going to have to leave early, so we've shifted a little bit to hear from Cliff again before he has to get on the road.
I really want to express my appreciation for the excellent work that the prior panel did. This is hard evidence. As I said yesterday, the evidence that Jonathan Simon presented in the Moss versus Bush case and Dr. Richard Hayes Phillips presented was under oath, subject to cross-examination. And that's called real evidence in our court system. What I wanted to say in the panel this afternoon in regard to election justice, subbing for Susan Truitt, who could not be here, who was one of the other lawyers in Moss versus Bush, is that I think we need to follow the leadership of this outstanding statesman that Bob Fetrakis referred to yesterday, Thor Hearn. Thor was the general counsel for the Bush-Cheney campaign. He's in a law firm in Missouri, and he came to Ohio, the Bob Ney hearing, and he presented testimony on behalf of an election institute. And Brad Freeman checked this out, as did I. He didn't disclose his background at all. He represented himself to be a nonpartisan person. He's obviously partisan. But part of his presentation included the fact that they have organized 7 law firms, one of them being Squire Sanders and Dempsey, which is a global law firm. And also that firm served as general counsel for the Bush-Cheney campaign in Ohio to function, to litigate and defend or offend. And this group is behind this lawsuit I told you about that attacks, it's in the name of 2 individuals in a rural county, but it attacks this terrible voter registration effort that was undertaken by democratically oriented groups prior to the election. So that lawsuit is pending. It's a racketeering lawsuit. I believe that what we need to do is follow his lead. We need to create a consortium of lawyers and law firms all over this country. We need to create a consortium of organizations and individuals all over this country to pull together what we've seen here through Bernie's leadership, pull together the facts, where we need to file a lawsuit to enforce a Freedom of Information request, we have people to file a lawsuit. Where we need to file a corrupt organization, racketeering lawsuit in a state or a federal, a suit of national scope, we need to file that. And it cannot be, Bob Fetrakis and I have a pending lawsuit or an effort to use a federal lawsuit to do this. If it's just Bob and me, if it's just two of us, if it's just one organization, like the Alliance for Democracy, I can bet any amount of money that I had that we would get knocked off. We would be found having committed suicide or died some mysterious traffic accident. So there as at the time of our revolution, it needs to be grassroots. It needs to be all of us. It needs to be a lot of us. If it's a few of us, we won't make it. And so we need help. I proposed a concept on Thursday night to the National Council of the Alliance for Democracy that we create, we broaden our Ohio Honest Election Campaign to be an American Honest Election Campaign, that we affiliate with any other organization. We invite individuals to be part of this. I've suggested that the Free Press, which has done an outstanding job of getting the word out. Everything that we filed in court, all the evidence, was almost instantly on the Free Press, accessible to people all over the world. We have an outlet. We have this phenomenal system called the Internet for getting the word out. And if we work together as grassroots, and I consciously wore this, my traveling outfit, but also in honor of the Ukraine citizens. We can do it here. And I understand what Jonathan's saying about, you know, what, aren't we jeopardizing the economy of this country? Look, China, they're critical observers of what's going on here. Our reputation as a nation is already in question. And if we as citizens reestablish truth-based vote counting, reality-based vote counting, and restore honest government in this country, our stock in this world will come back up. You know, the reason America is loved around the world is because of the founding fathers giving us a constitution that prohibited totalitarian government. We're not supposed to have a one-party system envisioned by Karl Rove. And certainly we're not supposed to envision a criminal conspiracy governing this country, getting away with it, unexamined, unaccountable. And if they get away with this last election, you can be sure it won't stop there. So we are literally fighting, you talked about we're not comparable to the Constitutional Convention. We are at the point of the Declaration of Independence. Are we going to stand to reaffirm the values on which this country is based, which our values are respected around the world, and retake our place as leaders in the world for democracy, including the wonderful United Nations that we helped found? And from an economic standpoint, the idea that we should be spending $500 billion a year to be the policemen of the world and to be the tyrants of the world is an absurdity. We're in competition with China in economics. When they start beating us, when they say, by the way, we're doubling your interest rate, folks, we saw how the credit cards did it to the little people over there, we've decided it's good business. What are we going to do, threaten to blow them off the face of the earth because we have an overwhelming predominance of military weapons? It's useless. It's insanity, and it needs to stop. And it stops when we hold the Bush people and Karl Rove accountable for the fraud that they perpetrated in this last election. I believe that the entire attack on Social Security and everything else that's going on is all part of this diversionary tactic, because what they are deathly afraid of, the jugular, as Jonathan referred to it, the jugular is the fraud that they perpetrated in this last election. The evidence is there. As Richard Phillips said, the votes are paid. We have 70, approximately 75% of the ballots in Ohio are paper that can be examined. All we need to do is count the votes. And I hope that we'll be able to work together to get this done. The Alliance for Democracy is a very flexible vehicle. It's willing to be an organizational support, an associate of everyone here. The Free Press is prepared to create bureaus in every city of this country. And when we show that we are going to stand and we are going to work, we're going to bring the science into the process, the mainstream media and litigate, the mainstream media will cover that because it is news. I am not a critic of the mainstream media, as I said yesterday. They have not covered this because Kerry took a walk, went to the sidelines, and the lady from New Hampshire. Remember, the Bush people financed an attack on Howard Dean in the Iowa election, Iowa caucus. They did not want Howard Dean. They recognized that he would not roll over for this sort of thing. He opposed the Iraq war, and he would have opposed the fraud in this election. So I'm very sorry not to be here with you the rest of the day. My wife is ill, and we have to go back to Columbus, and I really thank the opportunity for being here, and I really appreciate each and every one of you being here, and I hope we can work together to restore democracy and truth and science, science-based government, science-based election, fact-based elections in this country. Thank you so much.